Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You are listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprungs disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprungs with a positive message throughout.
Hello and welcome to episode 76 of Tom's Hirschsprungs podcast. I am delighted to welcome back Georgina Merkel. Georgina, welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me back.
No, you're very welcome. We've got lots of stuff to talk about, lots and lots of stuff. You've been very, very busy, as many people may know already. We will talk about your busy venture in a bit. But we've got, a few topics that we're going to cover, mainly just little bits around Hirschsprung's stats, some current research. We are going to talk about the website that you have launched, which is fantastic, by the way. Absolutely love it. And then we'll give a little update on your son, Freddie, a little bit later on. So if we kind of go from the top, there is a lot of Hirschsprung's stats out there. Very, very difficult, I would imagine, to sort of accurately grab all of those stats. But I know you've been doing an awful lot of research. What kind of things have you come across?
Do you know what? It's you're right. There are so much stats out there, but there's relatively limited studies. And I ended up down a rabbit hole of some really technical studies about surgery, and I actually read a lot of it and didn't understand any of it. I was like, right, I'll go back to the ones I understand, because they're complex to read. And, you know, not everyone's got the time to sit there and sort of read it and digest it and really understand it. So I thought it was a great idea if we had a chat about it, because there is quite a bit out there. And I think we sort of have these key stats that get thrown around with, like, how many people are diagnosed a year in the UK specifically, and then what the ratio is that we see all the time, which is 1 in 5,000. And I guess amongst the Hirschsprungs community, we talk about that because we've got our sort of the family focused UK Facebook group, where we're seeing people join because they think that their child or they might have Hirschsprung's disease, and they're talking about it, and then late diagnosis. And when you're in something, you see loads of it, so sometimes it can be hard to sort of see the stats. And more research is happening now, which is helpful, but I've picked out 3 or 4 key studies which I focus on UK based, because if you end up falling into global research, you can fall off a bit of a cliff in terms of looking at Japan, where there's quite a bit of research, and the US as well. But I've sort of stayed in the UK and Ireland, really. But the first one I wanted to look at is a study called Hirschsprung's disease in the UK and Ireland, incidents and anomalies. And it's 2017, so, you know, fairly recently, but it looked at infants born between 2010 and 2012, so it's just under 2-year period that they're looking at, and there were 305 children presenting before 6 months with Hirschsprung's disease. And the research was carried out across the 28 paediatric surgical centres in the UK and Ireland. So on the whole, children with Hirschsprung's are referred to one of those where they're treated. And just some of the stats from that were quite interesting. So the ratio with this was actually 1 in 5,500 rather than 1 in 5,000. So that interested me a little bit because we hear that one in 5,000, but it was actually 1.8 in 10,000. So it's slightly less than, you know, what we hear. The male to female ratio is what we know out there, which is that boys are 3 times more likely to be affected than girls, which is interesting. But what I found really interesting was one of the key diagnosis clues, I guess, that someone's got Hirschsprung's disease is not passing meconium within 48 hours. That's the big glaring sign that's in all your maternity notes, and it's in that piece of paper when you get discharged, and it says if your child meets any of these criteria. But only 48% of those children who were diagnosed, 48% actually passed meconium. So only 52 didn't. So actually, is it a diagnostic clue when it only covers half of those children? It's a really interesting one.
Yeah, it's partially, isn't it? Because I was one of those, that percent, where I did pass meconium, but I still have Hirschsprung's. I was diagnosed after 2.5 weeks. So usually, I know you said 48 hours, but I've, again, doing as many episodes as I have all day, every day, I have come across so many different ways, different stages of diagnosis.
Yeah.
And it's not always that standard, didn't pass meconium, 48 hours, bang, Hirschsprung's.
And that's what I think. I think, like, often those more district hospitals, those local hospitals, they're looking out for some key criteria. And that is usually not passing meconium within 48 hours. It's distended tummy and it's signs that the child is unwell, right? Vomiting, green, something like that. But if those key diagnostic clues don't cover the whole proportion of children who've got Hirschsprung's and get that diagnosis within 6 months, not even thinking about those that get that later diagnosis, it's not actually clear-cut diagnostic criteria, is it? So I think it just stood out to me as something that is a really interesting element that I think could be discussed in terms of NHS protocol in the UK about what they're looking for at point in those first couple of hours of birth. And I would be interested to see at what point that meconium, there's for those 48% of people who pass meconium, at what point was that within that 48 hour window? Was it 1 hour, 10 hours? Is it is it 36 hours? Is it 12 hours? Like, could that window be amended and to look at that?
Potentially. I mean, it's interesting. 48 hours is a long time. You know, is it, like you said, is it 1 hour or is it 47 and a half? Because that's a world of difference, potentially.
It is. It's a long time. And also, if they're looking for other signs like distended tummy, signs of clinical illness. You know, Freddie didn't have those. He was 56 hours old before we were transferred to Alder Hey. And I think it's interesting that's criteria. So I think that maybe the early signs can be missed and that maybe the criteria could be adapted to open up a wider window and district hospitals could be educated about looking out for those signs, because we know that Hirschsprung's is rare and we know that they're not always looking for the rare things because they're rare, right? But it's a great window to pick that up, because sending a child home for parents who are often sleep deprived in that new area. And I mean, I'm talking to all my friends, they all go home and go, is this normal? What's this? And it can feel a bit lonely, that bit. But you know, when you're in the safety of a hospital and that's what their clues they're looking for, I think it's interesting then that maybe primary care, such as things like midwives and GP surgeries, and then we're looking at diagnostic hospital, the district hospitals where that diagnosis is picked up and then referred into the paediatric surgical centre for support. Maybe there's a bit of movement there in terms of what that looks like in the future. But I was interested as well, 86% of those children diagnosed received a rectal washout as the first treatment step. From most people I talk to, that's kind of the first step now when they've got those signs. And we're looking at 27% of people, for those children, babies, washouts failed and they had a stoma. I think in the end, 36% of those infants ended up having a stoma. So there's also a gap of people who get the stoma later, just like Freddie, who are getting that stoma later, but a good proportion getting them early in those first weeks when they get the diagnosis. But then there's also a lot of people going home doing rectal washouts, and it's not something you hear about people doing at home. It's a big responsibility, I think.
Yeah, you're right. It is. And again, I speak to so many parents who've had to do the washouts when they get home. And it is a huge task, you know, it's something that, you know, maybe, you know, a week ago you weren't necessarily prepared for, and then suddenly you have to do, you know, your whole world is then turned completely upside down, I guess.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So I had another look at another study, 2021, which looked at outcomes for 5 to 8 years of age for children with Hirschsprung's disease, which is interesting because it's hard for parents to make decisions in those early days and weeks and a diagnosis when they don't have sort of any understanding of what life's going to look like. And I think that's a big scary thing. And so I think it's great that we have some information about what outcomes look like, but then that I'm going to talk about this, more research being done into this, which I think will be helpful in the later years when we've got some idea of what a typical experience looks like, if there is such one, because as we know, every child with Hirschsprung's often has a different treatment plan, a different experience, and like there are some shared experiences, but everybody you speak to, they've got this whole range of experience and stories, really, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of lucky we did, otherwise I'd be out of a podcast if every episode was the same.
I love that. And do you know what's even more interesting as well? I'm a bit of a stats geek, I love this, but the same key people show up in the authors of the studies that you're looking at, which is good, and that shows that the key people across sort of the paediatric surgical sphere who are invested in research, and that we're seeing that, because, you know, I mean, rare things, I guess, are interesting, but there are rarer things than Hirschsprung's disease. So, you know, I think, interesting. But this study looked at various different things. So unfortunately, it looked at mortality, so death rates. It also looked at bowel and bladder function, which I think is the interesting one for a lot of people. Whether short segment, long segment, or total colonic Hirschsprung's we could see a difference essentially in the stats there. And then they also looked at how many people required a reoperation. And then finally, they looked at quality of life. So we can see these key different areas that hopefully over time we'll see, you know, maybe some trends going through what we're looking at. But I think it's helpful to know that 95% of children survived, which is good. That sort of the rate of mortality with Hirschsprung's disease is very, very low now, and that's because we have extensive pediatric surgical centres with incredible ICUs, and, you know, hopefully not in the same situation as you were, Tom, in terms of not knowing, and, you know, your life was saved by one person, you know.
I mean, we're going back 33 years now. But that piece of research was new research at the time, which was the shot of magnesium if you've got tachycardia, where the heart rate starts to climb over, I think it's 100 beats a minute. Shot of magnesium slows the heart rate down. But I guess things like that we, you know, are now, you know, we know a lot more, help, I guess, that mortality rate.
Definitely. So when we're looking at bowel and bladder function, which is one of the things people think about, stoma or no stoma. So a large percentage of children didn't have a stoma, and that was age 5 to 8 years. So it was 87% no stoma, 13% with a stoma. But only 5% of those stomas were intended to be permanent at the time the study was done. So it's a small percentage of people who go on to have a permanent stoma, and some of those are temporary due to be reversed. But in terms of incontinence, fecal incontinence, so that is a 60-40 split, well, 57-43 split with yes. So a large proportion of those children aged 5 to 8 are still experiencing difficulty going to the toilet. And that's a really interesting point to wonder about, whether when we are understanding what impact Hirschsprung's is going to have in those early years when we talk about pull-through surgery, that parents are informed that that is, on the whole, fairly common, that there are going to be difficulties. And whether that's something that we parents are informed about on a regular basis so they can understand. Because I know some people I've spoken to get the whole it's pull through and done sort of cure in inverted commas there. And that's a common thing people hear. Maybe is it helpful to know that in advance, that that's what you may experience, that's normal? Does it normalize it if we know that's the case, or does it scare people? It's a tricky one, I guess.
Yeah, I think I guess from my point of view, and the people I've managed to talk to, a lot of people I talk to are in your situation where they have a child who's one or under, and we talk about the pull through and we talk about, you know, the diagnosis and whatnot. I haven't interviewed very many parents who have 5 to 8 year olds. I have just done an episode with Tash, who has children around that age. And I think it's one of very few episodes I have done with children sort of maybe between sort of 5 to 10. A lot of people are either adults like me or have much younger children. So I guess it's really difficult to sort of give a view on that, because I wouldn't know as much.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's just things to think about, and to, like, when we're reflecting on the experience for parents of children with Hirschsprung's disease, knowing whether this information is helpful to know and informative. Everyone's different. I mean, I love info, so it helps me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's nice. I think what's helpful, I think on the whole, most people tell me, is it's helpful to know you're not alone. I think that's the key. So maybe this information is helpful. When we move on to Hirschsprung's associated enterocolitis, looking at those stats, it's actually a real 50-50 split on those children who'd experienced at least one episode of enterocolitis since diagnosis, really 50-50. So that's another thing that's interesting as well, because going home with that diagnosis of either whether you get it early or late, you'll worry about enterocolitis and what the likelihood of that is. And, you know, there isn't a lot of clear info on that, is there? So,
no. But it's another word that, again, because I know we talked about this a little bit, because we're in that bubble of that Hirschsprung's bubble where we either research all the time, we talk to people who've got it all the time. We hear that word so often that we kind of maybe think that it is associated with Hirschsprung's. So it's interesting to know that it is, you know, half and half.
Yeah, really 50-50. And then maybe that's a settling thought that it's not 90 or 80%, you know, it's a 50-50. It's possible, you know, not likely, but possible. So that changes your outlook on the way you look at children's experiences when they come home as well, because parents are looking out for those signs. If you know it's a 50-50 chance, you know, I don't know if that's more setting or unsetting. I don't know. And then finally, they did look at people who required assistance to maintain voluntary bowel movements, which is whether you needed laxatives, enemas, and irrigation. So the washouts, and then the different types of enemas, irrigations. So looking at those. So 50% of those children required no assistance. So again, that's an interesting one, whereas 50% did require some support. And the majority of that is laxatives, which many children with Hirschsprung's disease go on for a period of time, at least, as well as children who don't have Hirschsprung's disease take laxatives as well. And you have to remember this study's on, I think, if this is 227 children. So it's not a huge proportion of children to look at, but it's helpful to look at a cross section of people.
I'd say it is a large amount of Hirschsprung's children. I wouldn't say, you know, if you were to do a study on 227 footballers, that's not a lot. But 227 Hirschsprung's people, to me, that sounds like quite a lot of people to find.
Yes, and I guess the point of this was following them through from birth. Then the 5 to 8 is where they looked at this information. And interestingly, when looking at short segment or long segment or tonic-clonic, so that was two categories they split into. They put long segment and tonic-clonic in the same category, and then short segment was its own category. It doesn't look like across, I mean, there's bits and pieces, but across the whole, the stats tend to be the same. So it doesn't seem to matter, I guess, whether the length of effective bowel is short or long segment and tonic-clonic, the sort of outcomes appear to be pretty similar. So stoma is slightly more likely, enterocolitis is slightly more likely with long segment or tonic-clonic. But interestingly, yeah, fairly similar, which is interesting, isn't it? Because in those early days of pull through and taking out the entire large intestine versus that short piece, or does, I'll be really looking at whether that matters in terms of long-term outcomes. That's an interesting one. I think we need more information on as research continues, because I think that's interesting to know.
Yeah, I think so, because I think the general line of thought may well be, oh, well, if you have more affected, you're going to, you know, have greater issues potentially. Yeah. But that's really interesting that there isn't too much difference in terms of stats.
And before we sort of move on to quality of life, the last thing that they looked at in terms of practical medical element was looking at unplanned reoperations after pull through. So how many people required another surgery? And then around 17% had one, 8% had two, 5% had three, but 14% had four or more.
Interesting. Yeah. That is interesting. Yeah, because I guess, again, surgeries just in general are a tricky one because, again, just going off the people I meet, there are people who have the pull through and then fine and everything's great. And there are people who've had 100+ surgeries. So that's an interesting one.
It is. And then just touching on quality of life, which they looked at, understandably, I think those who had difficulty going to the toilet, so incontinence, they had a lower quality of life than those who didn't, which I think is an understandable measure there, isn't it? But it's interesting that that was looked at, because I think that's an important element that we might not look at when we look at stats, because we're looking at the medical side of things, but we're looking at people's experiences as well.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. That's a really interesting thing that you can't necessarily put a number on, but it is a really, really important point as well. I know you say that kind of stands to reason as common sense to a certain extent, but yeah, interesting the study focused on that as well.
Yeah. And I mean, I won't touch too much on the other two studies that I looked at, but one was about the management of Hirschsprung's disease in the UK and Ireland. So how it's changed over the years, and it's changed hugely, Tom. I mean, like, look at the surgeries that you've had versus that the children now are having, look very different, like very different. And that's through, I guess, surgical familiarity and surgeons doing similar surgery over and over again, because they get more competent and people are training and looking at this. So I think that's interesting. But one thing that stood out to me in this study, which was done in 2010, said that across the 26 pediatric surgical centres, 65% of those had a named lead surgeon for Hirschsprung's disease, which meant more coordinated care. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Well, that helps. Most certainly helps.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that we've both been to hospitals that are very much specialists in Great Ormond Street and Alderhay. And they're very much sort of world-renowned when it comes to Hirschsprung's care. I mean, the amount of people I've spoken to who've been to either one of those. But yeah, very interesting to know that the coordinated care, because I find that something is, I mean, you must know this more as a parent, that you don't then have to explain things 100 times over and over again to a new consultant, to a new nurse, to a new, you know, that must really help.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, because almost all the parents I speak to feel like care could be better coordinated. And they've had sometimes not a great experience with explaining going through the history, maybe waiting lists for care, which I think we see across the NHS for all areas. But interestingly, that's something that comes up for a lot of the families I talk to. And from what I can tell, is so many people have had such a different experience, even at the same hospital and the same surgeon, I think. And that could be a part and parcel of what we know about the strain on the NHS. But interestingly, I think that's just, it might, in 2010, they were looking at more coordinated care. I think in 2025, we can say that potentially should be more coordinated. Maybe that's not fizzled down into parent experience yet. Maybe there's more to do. Maybe, yeah, I thought that was an interesting one. But we do know that there is a trend towards more modern, minimally invasive surgeries where possible. So keyhole surgery is where we're moving forward to, which I think is interesting, isn't it? That, you know, trends across surgery in general, but attempting to see sort of greater consistency in how children are treated. The final one I looked at was more overview of what do we define as success in treatment for a child with a surgical condition. And anyone who doesn't know, if their child's had a surgery in the first couple of years, they may be able to take part in some research and join in a sort of register, which is called CSOR. It's CSOR. It's a database, and the idea is it's a children's surgery outcome reporting program, 5 years, and the aim is to look at whether it's possible to reduce the variation of health and well-being for children who have early surgery. So it's interesting, if your child has had surgery in those early years and they need to have one of six conditions, Hirschsprung's disease being one of those, but you can join the database and you can feedback different things about outcomes, well-being. But the research out of that will be interesting. But they're looking at things like quality of life, again, important, duration of survival, number and type of operations, and then hospital-related infections or hospital-treated infections relating to that condition. So I think these are elements where there is some research on that already, but it'd be interesting to see what happens when that sort of 5 years is up and we see that. I think there's more emphasis on quality of life. I'm not sure.
I think that's such an important point. I think that, again, I go back to speaking to so many people through this, and the main question asked in so many different ways is kind of like, will my child be okay? What's going to happen in the future? You know, what are they going to be all right when they're 4 and they're going to school, 5, 8, you know, when they're 12 and they're going into secondary education? And of course, you know, we can't answer that straight away, but it is that burning question, is my child going to be fine? And no, we'll never have a definitive answer to that.
Yeah.
But the closer we can get to that, the better. And I think we can get closer in terms of doing these quality of life studies to not give a definitive answer, but to say, okay, well, we did this study and this happened, and we did this study, and, you know, if we did this type of, you know, exercise or whatever it might be, then this happened. And I think that's probably amongst some of the most important research, I think, out of everything we've said so far.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's going to be interesting over the next few years, the next decade, 2 decades, as research is becoming part and parcel of Hirschsprung's treatment, as far in our experience anyway. That may not be the case elsewhere across the UK, but hopefully we will have more information, and that will help parents understand and make maybe more informed decisions about what they choose to do and what life looks like in the longer term. And the other thing to remember, Tom, and I always try to remember this about sort of, most people talk about a topic when it affects their life. So for many families who've got a child with Hirschsprung's disease, or they've got Hirschsprung's disease in the family, they're talking about it in the years where it affects them. Mm. And then, you know, we hear this a lot, you know, sort of grow out of it, not necessarily grow out of it, but many children stop being as ill, you know, if we see occurrence of illnesses, for example, later on. And as we grow, so there is a huge proportion of people who've got Hirschsprung's disease aren't talking about it because it's not a daily discussion topic anymore.
Yeah.
So I think you're going to see, for parents, they're going to see posts that people are making, and we're going to see like the content that sort of is out and about. That's often times, you know, not all the time, but oftentimes by people who are living in the moment being affected by it. But there are many positive stories or families living with Hirschsprung's in a way that it's not affecting day-to-day life, but we don't always see that because you only see what you're in. So I think that's an important acknowledgement as well, because it's helpful to know, which is why things like the buddy scheme and the community planning and the meetups and stuff are going to be helpful, because hopefully we'll stay in contact with those families for longer, and we'll be able to see as life sort of settles down and it isn't affected in the way you know that we see.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We see for many families,
Yeah, I think it kind of again goes back to that bubble. I mean, I get messages from people all the time, and one of the messages I had recently was, "Oh, can you do more episodes where not a lot happens?" And it's just like, "Oh, they have Hirschsprungs and everything's fine," you know. And I mean, one, that would be like 5 minutes and probably wouldn't make a podcast. But two, I would actually like to do those episodes. And there are some episodes out there of people who've, you know, gone on to do really amazing things and their Hirschsprungs hasn't really affected them too much. But yeah, it is interesting. It is interesting to take it into context because people are generally going to talk about it a lot more when they are going through it, as opposed to, because there are plenty of people out there, spoken to many, who they are diagnosed, they had to pull through, they might have some issues, you know, when they're sort of 1-2 years of age. Generally it's the shorter segment stories, but they have a couple of issues when they're a little bit younger, but probably past the age of 2, 3, 4, all they know is that they have a big scar and that's it. Yeah. And everything else is fine. So there are a lot of stories that are out there like that, but again, you probably may not have heard them because people probably wouldn't necessarily share them because they think, well, there's not a lot to say.
Yeah, I think that's super important to know those stories. For me, if people feel comfortable sharing that, I think that's really important, like, information, because like we may have seen in that study that looked at children aged 5 to 8, not much difference between the short segment and the long segment. But does that carry on being the same? Do we see a divergence in that in later ages? Do we see what are people's experiences? Someone told me on TikTok the other day that their child grew out of Hirschsprung's disease without surgery, which I thought was really interesting because it may have been a little bit of a troll, but I actually said, like, tell me more. Tell me more.
Yeah, I'd love to know how you regrow ganglion cells, because if you do, you'll be a very rich person.
That's what I said. But interestingly, yeah, there are so many people that reply to my story, you know, my videos on TikTok, and they say, this person had Hirschsprung's disease and now they're this age and they're perfectly fine. It's like, great, let's hear those stories. I really want to hear those stories, as well as those that are going through it, because I think that the whole picture is way better than no picture. So,
I mean, I have had a couple of stories. That there's one I remember in particular when I had Louis Healy on the podcast, and I had a phone call with him beforehand, and he was like, oh, you know, I don't really know a lot about Hirschsprung because it hasn't really affected me. But he was like, yeah, you know, it hasn't really affected me. So we just mainly talked about his acting and actually it had affected him more than he realized because he didn't know his own story. But there are lots of people out there who don't have as many, you know, symptoms and struggles as others.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I want to know those stories.
Yeah.
Do we talk about... Yeah. Put on the podcast, back on the website. We need to know these stories. Should we talk about the research? And I've sort of chosen these three research projects to talk about because Freddie's enrolled in two of them, which I think is interesting. One is the one that we've seen in the news, and I think that's an interesting one that people are desperate to know about because this looks more of a cure, but... I'm going to talk about this one first, which is the more sciencey one, but then I'm going to go into the other ones afterwards. So this research project builds on some previous research that's been done that reveals that stem cells exist in the bowels of babies with Hirschsprung's disease. So those of you who know will know about ganglion cells and ganglion nerve cells, and those, they aren't there. When we have Hirschsprung's disease, and then sometimes that's a small portion, sometimes that's a long portion, sometimes that's the whole of the colon, just depends on the person. But so we know that there are stem cells in the bowels of babies with Hirschsprung's disease. So essentially, I guess, the inference there is that they didn't turn into the cells they should have done. They're just there, right? So this piece of research, it is called, it's called Hawaii. I love the names of these, but it actually stands for Hirschsprung's Advances Working Towards, and I can never say this word, autologous. Logimus, I don't know what it was.
Yeah, that'll do.
No, logos, okay. Working towards autologous tissue therapies. This is a research study. It's being funded by Bowel Research UK. And the aim is to look at treatment. So they are looking at whether the stem cells have, whether they can be turned on, can they grow into functioning nerves after you've been born? That's the question. So it's a really interesting one. It's a PhD that's being funded. So it's an in-depth research study. But it's interesting. We talked about stats before, but the stats that they include in this sort of press release and announcement was about 170 babies in the UK each year. And they are saying that around 30% of children have chronic bowel problems. So that's constipation, incontinence, or inflammation. And 10% of those require a long-term stoma. So we've talked about different research, but this is sort of the parceled up studies, statistics that they're looking at. But this is a really interesting piece of research. It will take years, you know, a decade to do, but it's going to be really interesting to look at whether the nerve stem cells in the lower part of the bowel can turn into the nerve cells that might make the bowel work normally. And can they prompt that happening? Is there a medication or something that could happen that will turn those on? It's going to be a long time in the making, but it's a really interesting piece of research, I think, to see whether that's going to happen, because that could be potentially a cure in the future.
That's the really, really interesting. I mean, they're all very interesting, but I think it's that almost hope, I guess, of can you fix Hirschsprung's. I mean, we just mentioned, people on TikTok all the time tell us how Hirschsprung's is fixed. I have people who like to call themselves doctors tell me all the time how you can take this pill and fix Hirschsprung's, and oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. So but it would be really interesting to see, can you switch on ganglion cells? Yeah. And if you can, that I mean, that would be probably more a game changer than anything else, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. That would remove the surgical aspect. And we'll need to see further. And I imagine it will be decades rather than a decade of information, because it takes a lot of research. But I'm really pleased that Bowel Research UK funding that. I'm really pleased that University of Liverpool and Alder Hey Children's Hospital are involved in that, because I think that is a really interesting study. And I know other hospitals around the UK are looking at the stem cells as well, which is really interesting. So we'll have to see how that one goes. The next study is called Aloha, and this is long-term qualitative and quantitative outcomes of children with Hirschsprung's disease and anorectal malformation. So that is another condition that children can be born with that affects essentially your rectum. You are born potentially without... It's the anus and the rectum mouth are not formed properly, is what I understand of it. I don't know too much about it, because obviously it's not something that I'm familiar with too much. But I'm interested in this study. This study follows the experiences and the outcomes of children with Hirschsprung's disease and anorectal malformation through the years. So we can see what their experience is like, and that is going to aid in parent information when at diagnosis and later on. And I think that is really interesting. And I think it's interesting because we're looking at the surgical procedures that are happening now and looking at that. So I think that's really interesting. And hopefully we'll show and be and show the impact of knowledge being helpful in that. And whether sort of there are different function outcomes between subgroups and things like that. So yeah, really interesting. That is going to have around 1,200 estimated patients across the whole 5 years of the study, which I think is really interesting. So yeah, that's cool.
That's a lot more than the 227 we had last time.
Yes, exactly.
A lot more. That's obviously such a good thing as well. That again, the more people we can find, the more in depth the studies can be, the more legitimate, I guess, the studies become as well. So that is 1,200 is really, really high. That's an excellent number.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think that's going to be a great one. Freddie's enrolled in this, so we get surveys at regular points throughout. So just have the first one being his year one, and that's going to be really interesting. And I hope that they will continue to fund this so that we can see outcomes into your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 70s. Because when we're looking at people with Hirschsprung's disease who were born 50 years ago, the surgical techniques are so different that it's almost impossible to say and to look at to compare, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a really great study.
And just while we've got sort of 5 minutes to go, you mentioned that Freddie's enrolled in a couple of these studies.
Yeah.
For anybody who's not, I know you mentioned a little bit about the survey, but how does that process kind of work? Have they sort of gone in depth on that?
Yeah. So what, in terms of enrolling, how does that work? Is that what you're asking?
Just everything. How the whole process?
So we're at Alderhay Children's Hospital, which is where the studies that I've talked about are taking place. There's a third study as well. And you enroll by simply being asked by the surgeons that are taking care of you. The surgeons that look after Hirschsprung's disease are involved in the research. Therefore, they ask if you want to sign up. And I actively really am interested in the whole research side of things. So I think it's really important. And information's anonymous, so it's not going to be Freddie Evans's experience that like this in the future. It's going to be he's part of a number, and I think that's really helpful. Anything to help other parents. And I know we've only got a few minutes to go, so I'll mention the other one, which has just started. Freddie only enrolled just over a month ago, but this is called the Beach Study. How cool are the names?
It's brilliant.
This is Babies with Enterocolitis, a study of fecal calprotectin in Hirschsprung's disease. The idea is that when children are in hospital, they are going to take samples of poo or stone rat poo, depending, and they're going to test those for fecal calprotectin. The idea being that potentially maybe we could identify children who are more likely to get enterocolitis than children who don't, because they're looking for levels of calprotectin. Is that a useful test? It's not expected to be a definitive study, but yeah, will it be useful in the future? That's what's helpful, to find out if more children are more likely to get it or not. You know, do you fall into the 50% of children that get enterocolitis, or do you not? So that's an interesting one for me as well, particularly as they know it's not going to be definitive, but it's interesting.
I think they're all fantastic and really, really interesting. And thank you so much for sharing both the research and the stats with us. We will, coming up next week, will be a part two where we will dive into a little bit more on the research. The website launch, we'll do that next week. And also an update on your son, Freddie. And just very quickly, where can people find you?
Yes, you can find me at Live With Georgina on TikTok and Instagram. Mostly Instagram is where I prefer to be, but you have to hang out on TikTok these days. And also at hirschsprungsdisease.co.uk.
Brilliant. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprungs Podcast, or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprungs_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll bring you another episode soon.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.